On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
I'm joined in the studio by our newspaper panel, Colm O'Gorman, Executive Director of Amnesty Ireland, and Aoife Barry, Assistant News Editor with thejournal.ie. You're both very welcome and thanks for coming in. Colm, your first time in the studio for quite a while.
Yeah, since March last year, which seems fairly extraordinary. It's odd not to be doing this from home down a, you know, FaceTime or a WhatsApp connection or whatever else. Yeah, but it's great. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah. It's bad when this has become the peak of our social lives, isn't
it? Novelty now,
Even if we are all behind screens and distance and everything else.
Exactly.
We might start with some of what Paul Reid has meant there, and Colm ask you about that booster programme. So Paul Reid seeming to think it can be done as well as helping out the third world. Do you think is that realistic?
Well, first of all, let's just again congratulate the HSE and everybody working within the system for the vaccine rollout here in Ireland. It's quite phenomenal. I mean, if you remember back to when all of this started, you had an awful lot of people from within and outside the system and commentators on the system saying they could not possibly scale up to giving a quarter of a million vaccine doses every week. And they've proven that they can do that and an awful lot more. And they should be hugely congratulated for that. It'll be very interesting after the pandemic ends. Maybe people might look back and say, so if our health system can operate in this way, and if when we have a clear outcome that we need to achieve, we can achieve it, what's blocking us doing that in other areas? That'll be a really important conversation to have, because we're obviously capable of it. And our systems are capable of it. So let's deal with that myth in the past that we all kind of scratch our heads and kind of go, butcher Ireland and the health system. We can do better. On vaccines, no, I don't believe that we can do both as things currently stand. The supply simply isn't there. We need 11 billion doses to vaccinate 70% of the global population. 11 billion doses. And still now, vaccination in the global south in poor and middle income countries is dependent upon acts of charity. We saw this week UNICEF's campaign that raised enough money to vaccinate a million people being celebrated, and it should be. The generosity of Irish people in that regard is fantastic. But let's just reflect on that for a moment. Imagine if we were living in a country where by accident of birth, our access to vaccines was dependent upon acts of charity from people in countries far away, individual people. So over the last year, we and many others as part of the People's Vaccine Campaign have been asking governments globally, challenging them, calling on them, demanding that they put in place mechanisms that would allow for the ramping up and the scaling up of vaccine production in countries where those vaccines are most needed through the waiving of intellectual property rights on the part of pharma companies who have received, by the way, 100 billion in public money to develop these vaccines. We want to see a temporary waiver, which is a mechanism that exists within international systems, that would allow for the technology and the know-how to be transferred to countries and capacity to be developed to scale up vaccine production. And instead, we've had many, many countries, the EU and Ireland, blocking that and telling us that the way forward is COVAX. The way forward is COVAX, which is now dependent upon donations from ordinary people because states are not donating effectively to COVAX in order to deliver vaccines. COVAX is part of the solution. It is not the solution. Mm. There are billions of people in the world now who do not have access to vaccines. Again, think about that. Their safety, their access to these life-saving medications and therapeutics and vaccines is dependent upon acts of charity from people in countries like ours. And then just take that forward a little bit. All of our safety is therefore dependent upon the possibility of random acts of charity by people across the world. Because as long as this virus continues to circulate, we will see the emergence of new variants. 2 years ago, nobody would have imagined this pandemic was possible, that this could happen. Everybody has been telling us for more than a year that the emergence of variants that could defeat vaccines is a very real possibility. We've come close to that, it would appear, in some regards with Delta, because it's more resistant to vaccines. Not the vaccines are very effective against it. That's fantastic. But are we honestly prepared to continue to take these risks so that pharma companies can make obscene profits rather than putting public health and human rights first? There were 9 new vaccine billionaires minted last year as a result of this investment of 100 billion of public money. How much money is enough? Mm. And at what point does public health and human rights go before the profits of pharma? And Ireland, as a member of the European Union, continues to maintain a position that it will prioritise intellectual property rights ahead of waiving those rights on a temporary basis to ensure that we can ramp up and scale. So no, we cannot both do boosters here and ramp up production significantly as things stand to be able to vaccinate people in the global south. Quite frankly, even if we weren't doing booster programmes, we still wouldn't be at a point of ramping up production to be able to vaccine in the global south effectively. But there is something very wrong with the idea that we're racing this far ahead and leaving huge part of the world's population completely alone and absolutely at the mercy, as I said, of acts of charity that ultimately can't deliver. Mm. I mean, they will not deliver. They make us feel good, but they won't deliver.
Eve, a lot of these points picked up as well in the papers, Luke O'Neill and Anthony Staines writing about them in the ramp up. What stands out to you from the COVID coverage this morning?
Yeah, if you look at Professor Luke O'Neill's article there in the Sunday Independent, there's a very stark image at the, or infographic at the top of it that really speaks to a lot of what Colin was saying there. So it looks at COVID-19 vaccine doses administered per 100 people, and it says only 1.2% of people in low-income countries have received at least one dose, and highlights two particular countries. So it looks at the Democratic Republic of Congo, where 0.10% or 0.1% of people have been given a vaccine dose there, in comparison to the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, where 175.05% have. So they said a study last week as well said that only 1 in 74 people in poorer countries had received, are vaccinated, whereas it's 1 in 2 people in rich countries. Like, we're so privileged, and, you know, by, again, like Colm was saying, by accident of birth, to be living here in Ireland where we have had the vaccination going so well. You know, I was one of the people who donated to that UNICEF campaign, and you think you're doing a really nice thing, but really, like Colm has detailed there, it goes far beyond the idea of just donating. You're getting into so many different kind of political, technological, you know, IP issues, and really there has to be will there among those who actually have the power to make these things happen, to make this change. And that's obviously where you're always butting up against the political will or otherwise. And I'm not just talking about our government here, obviously it's the global issues that we're talking about, and it's kind of a wake up call too. I mean, because, you know, even if you were to be really selfish about it and not care about anybody else in the rest of the world, which you don't want, but do you want to travel? Do you want tourism affected if you're thinking economically or whatever? You know, people not being fully vaccinated globally impacts on people, you know, across the world who are rich and lucky enough to have their double vaccinations. So it is kind of a big discussion that has to be had, and we can't lose sight of the global issue when we're lucky enough here on an individual level to be very privileged to be fighting about whether we should get vaccinated or not in some quarters of the world.
We're going to be talking a bit more about that global impact and what impact China is actually having on how we think about this pandemic and where it started and its influence over the World Health Organization. And Colin, really interesting story in the Sunday Times today, and they've given it a huge amount of play, three full spread pages inside as well as the front page story. And this is the relationship between China and the World Health Organization and what they're calling a power grab that not only fueled the pandemic, but it very much says has blocked any sort of inquiry as to whether we can find out where COVID actually came from.
Yeah, and you referenced it in your introduction when you were talking about the story itself, but the investigation looks at how China influenced the nature of the investigation that was carried out by the World Health Organization, but also had, it would almost seem like, editorial rights over its outputs in the end. And in particular, Dr. Peter Emberak, who led the inquiry last week, said that the idea that the virus originated with a Chinese laboratory employee was a likely hypothesis, whereas in the report it says it was extremely unlikely. And he rationalized that by saying that, well, if we'd left that in the report, it wouldn't have been worth the argument. We would have had to just wouldn't. So clearly, China had huge influence over the outputs from that report. So the independence of that investigation are clearly then very, very questionable. But I mean, it speaks to China's sensitivity. I mean, it should come as no surprise to anybody that China does not like criticism. Looks how it deals with any kind of moderate dissent, even, you know, minimal dissent within its own country, and how it treats its own people. So of course China will use every mechanism at its disposal to silence, to bully, to intimidate, and to suppress dissent or criticism. It will do that within any system, including within the UN system. It's not alone in that. I mean, the UN system is one within which, sadly, I mean, it's the best system that we have, but it's a very flawed system in many ways. It's one within which major global powers act completely out of narrow selfish self-interest rather than in acting in the context of global good. Look, for instance, at the way in which any permanent member of the Security Council can, without any explanation, veto any action that might be taken by the Security Council. And its role is to guarantee peace and security. It very often fails in that because of the conduct of countries like Russia, the United States, China in particular, yeah. But China is a malign state in many, many ways. We shouldn't be surprised by that. But this isn't something, I mean, I saw suggestions that, you know, the Times editorial says it, that some will say this is water under the bridge and the World Health Organization's failing when the pandemic cannot be undone. Well, I'm sorry, but if there are significant failings or questions of significant failings within any of these institutions that are critical to us at the global level, they have to be examined, they have to be investigated, and learnings have to be applied. So we can't simply say this can't be undone. We need to understand what happened. there will be future pandemics. You know, we are going to see, for 20 years, immunologists and virologists have been warning about the emergence of viruses that are animal-based and them jumping into the human species. We've seen examples of it before. This won't be the last one.
Mm.
So there's an awful lot that we need to learn from this.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, Aoife, because it does play into that idea of a future pandemic, and we all hope that this is the last one of our lifetime in the way the Spanish flu was 100 years, but certainly a lot of the epidemiological evidence says otherwise. I think what's particularly interesting, Colm kind of touched on it there, obviously this international pressure goes on for every country. Ireland lobbied heavily to get its seat on the UN Security Council. There was pressure applied there. But interesting in this report says that in the run-up to the elections of the Director General of the WHO, the last two heads of it were seen to be sympathetic to China. And right before both of those elections, the Chinese funding of African countries in particular nearly doubled in both cases. So there is obviously a big international power play here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting to read. There's like 4 pages or thereabouts, 3.5 pages on it. And just to go back a second to the idea of kind of where it all comes from, you can go back to, well, not where it all comes from, but you can go back to 2003 and see that WHO sources are saying that China felt humiliated because of, sorry, 2002, because the SARS outbreak, that China was criticized by WHO back then, and that this humiliation that it felt that it had suffered has led to now it feeling that it had to actually kind of step up when it came to the possibility of the COVID pandemic, you know, at the end of 2019 when all the information was first coming out. And it's so interesting to see that kind of being held as something where here we have again, this could be a SARS number two. Let us have control actually over how this is going to be done. And can we do it through the people that we have some sort of major connection with, who are like the key players, very high up, Director General of the WHO. And it has lots of really interesting details, you know, about kind of going back to the early days, about like how there was kind of statements coming out from Taiwan and whether or not China actually tried to kind of push that away, you know, to sow some doubt about whether the virus could pass rapidly between humans. And I think people, you know, have been turning to the WHO and their, you know, press conferences that they've been having since they announced that there was a pandemic or thereabouts in 2020 for information, to feel like there's people in charge who know what's happening. And they're going to tell us what's going on, even in the face of a lot of questions and of people wondering how is this going to develop. And then to read this and to realise that the average person might not realise that there's a lot of machinations going on behind the closed doors or the open doors of the WHO does make you feel like, okay, there's actually, you kind of feel a bit ignorant sometimes, I think, for people when they realise this is happening. And they also realise too, well, if all of these decisions were made that we didn't know about, if information was held back, could things have happened sooner? Could we be in a better position right now in August 2021? And that is kind of sickening to think about. And it's also really, really interesting, you know, to look at the kind of, you know, political connections, like you're saying, the donations made, the, you know, benefiting some countries above others just before somebody gets voted into a certain role. And I think that the WHO had been seen as being doing a really great job of informing us about what's happening. And this does put a, you know, bad taste in the mouth when you realise that there has been perhaps other things occurring behind closed doors while this pandemic has been spreading globally.
I
do think we need to be a little bit careful to separate out what people within the World Health Organization are doing from a public health perspective
the politics
of all of that.
They are two separate things, of course, but
Mike Ryan and others have done phenomenal work within the WHA.
And he's mentioned too in it.
Absolutely, protect people. But this kind of power playing at the political level within international institutions is a huge, huge issue. And there needs to be an awful lot more transparency around both elections and appointments to these kinds of roles. But I mean, China's been doing this for years. It's I'm going to get the term wrong now, but it's Belt and Road Program, where it invested in countries and bought up huge sections of countries and put huge money into countries and then effectively captured those countries at the political level because it had economic control over them, has been a massive, massive concern for a very, very long time indeed. Again, all the large powers to varying degrees do this. The adventures that we see them go on in part of the world. Look what's happening in Afghanistan right now. It's because of the naked self-interest of major global players who step in and exploit a situation to their own benefit. And we see it time and time again. And China is one of the worst offenders, but it's not unique in that regard.
And I think what you were mentioning there about the kind of individuals who are perhaps involved, you know, Michael Ryan, who we've seen so much over the last year, you know, was basically that he wanted to apply more pressure on China because he could see that the crisis at the end of 2019, start of 2020, was becoming a repeat of 2003. So like you said there, I mean, there is a difference between kind of who's involved in political things and who is, you know, doing the job they're supposed to be doing or whatever. But it's interesting to see him highlighted in particular and praised there for his particular role over the last year.
Colm, you mentioned it there, the situation in Afghanistan, and Sky now reporting this hour of a Taliban presence or procession through the centre of its capital, Kabul. We have been talking in the news about the acting Afghan Interior Minister saying there'll be a peaceful transfer of power to a new transition government, and talks have been taking place between the Taliban and the government over the surrender of the capital, Kabul. Colm, this, I think for a lot of people, just seemed to escalate incredibly quickly, because for many years, if you weren't paying a huge amount of attention to it, you would have thought the Taliban were seriously weakened, ISIS had become the dominant front there, but this is incredibly worrying things we're seeing in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and I mean, it'll appear very sudden to lots and lots of people, but we know that, for instance, from January until mid-July of this year, 270,000 people were displaced internally within Afghanistan because of the conflict. So the displacement of people because of the conflict has been enormous. In the first quarter of this year, civilian casualties in the conflict were up 29% on the same period in 12 months previously. So this conflict has been raging throughout the last number of years. And yes, it's picked up pace. It's very worrying indeed on one level to hear that Kabul has fallen quite so quickly. It looks like the Taliban will effectively take over the entire country right now. Most people don't understand necessarily how vulnerable a population, though, exists in Afghanistan. For instance, 65% of the population there are children and young people.
Wow.
65%. We know that there's about 3.5 million people who are internally displaced. And of course, there are millions of people who've had to flee the country as refugees. And that's a huge concern right now, because those refugee flows are going to increase. And before anybody responds immediately and starts getting, you know, up on their high horse, some of the usual people about going, we can't deal with floods of refugees arriving in this country. 90% of displaced Afghans are living in being hosted in two countries, as is often the case, Iran and Pakistan. So the international community has to step in very, very quickly indeed to make sure that those who are fleeing persecution, because we are going to see an increase in persecution in Afghanistan now, there's no question of that if the Taliban are taken over, or fleeing conflict, have access to protection. And that means ensuring that there are pathways to protection for people. Most people, by the way, want to stay within the neighbourhood, at least in the region within which they've been displaced. So we have to make sure that countries who are hosting refugees there are able to do that effectively and are resourced to do that effectively. So that's it's a massive, massive concern. It's going to be a very, very, very difficult period again for a country that has suffered so terribly very often because of, you know, the adventures of major powers in the region.
Difficult situation there. We will be bringing you more on that on the news bulletins on News Talk throughout the day. Aoife Barry, there's an awful lot in the papers today about the housing situation. I might leave it off to you where you start, but the one that caught my eye was the front page of the Sunday Independent. Half a billion euro for developers to coax them back into build. They need to be coaxed into making
developers.
Money.
It's a tough life, isn't it, if you're a developer? Can't even imagine what that must be like and how you need to be coaxed back into building. Where do you even start with the housing issues in Ireland? I mean, it's across the board, rental costs have gone up by about 5.6%, I think, in the last year or so. Talking about a 6% rise in the cost of actually buying a house. So that's how it's affecting your people who want to buy and who want to live somewhere in Ireland. And then, you know, there are the issues of whether or not things are actually being built, which they aren't. We know we need between 25,000 and about 50,000 units to be built, depending on who you're talking to actually house enough people in Ireland and to try and deal with the housing issues. But this particular story in Sunday Independent is saying that under the Housing for All strategy, which we're basically going to be seeing unveiled in a few weeks by Dara O'Brien, the housing minister, so people will need to keep an eye out for that, because there's going to be lots of different elements that we've been kind of, you know, getting a little hint of every now and then in the Sundays or in other publications. But in this is going to be €500 million provided directly to developers to get them to, it says, overcome concerns about making housing schemes a commercial success. Which, you know, I mean, I probably shouldn't be laughing when I'm talking about it. It's just, I suppose, when you see something like that, you do wonder, like, how do we know this is going to work? How do we know this is going to actually get what we need done? How is this going to solve the issues that have been ongoing for a very long time? It does say that it's in part to try and solve the issue of the fact that there is a lot of residential units granted planning permission, but no work has been done on them yet. So this is a way of trying to get the work done, and that there are brownfield and even greenfield sites that work needs to be done too. But I don't know, I'm really interested in seeing the full Housing for All strategy and to see how realistic it looks, whether it actually tackles the issues that are affecting the average person on the street, or whether it's giving money to developers to do something they might not even do. I mean, we have a very great long history here of developers kind of doing stuff and then being able to leave their ghost estates, you know, sit there, or their, you know, big massive huge buildings next door to, in the inner city of Dublin, next door to people's back gardens or whatever. Like, so the power is definitely in their hands as opposed to in your average person's hands, but it feels like.
The fact column, and it says in this, it's been a figure that's been out there, 80,000 planning permissions have been approved and are in the system. 40,000 of those are in Dublin. And they're not going, like, it just baffles me entirely that that much has been approved.
Despite the fact that property prices are now at or past the peak before the crash.
And going up and right? up and up. There are prices
and going up and up, like, and up indeed, yeah. Crazy. And yet somehow we're meant to believe that development is simply not economically viable.
Yeah.
That builders can't make a profit from prices that people can't afford to pay. Mm-hmm. So the solution is to give half a billion of our money. Like, it's not as if those houses are now going to be less expensive for us all. We're just going to pay them through public money and then, you know, pay a slightly lower price per person when we buy them. I mean, is there any guarantee that this is going to work? I can imagine, by the way, how this must feel to people like, you know, people campaigning on MicroAddress, for instance, to see half a billion euros being signed off to developers yet again whilst they're struggling to try and get their homes rebuilt because of flaws in their construction there. So that's an issue. But, you know, we're at a point yet again where housing policy has been developed. For instance, there are many experts on that question of planning permissions who have said and who believe that developers are simply holding on to development opportunities because prices are only going one way and they can maximise their profits by holding on to it. And of course, they'll also inflate prices to their maximum by holding back on supply. So, you know, there's a very real possibility that this half a billion will simply go into the developers' pockets, and they'll still hold off on development, hold off on sale to maximise price and maximise their return.
It's an argument that's been made by the Department of Finance, and I've debated Pascal Donohue on this before, that because when you start a project, you put a shovel in the ground today, you're not going to get any return out of that for 2 years, maybe 3 years. You have to build the whole estate, and they don't believe that in 2-3 years' time the market is going to be there. What are they seeing that we're not seeing?
They don't believe in 2 or 3 times that the market is going to be there. And yet there is no doubt about the fact that the property developers in the past have manipulated the market to maximise prices. That's what they do, right? So that's not an appalling thing to say about people who are in business. They're there to manipulate the market as much as they possibly can to guarantee the best possible returns for themselves. They've done that repeatedly. Is that what's happening again? I mean, are we seeing exactly the same thing? It makes no sense to the ordinary person that prices are at a level where they are unaffordable for pretty much everybody, and yet we still have developers and others saying that, yeah, but it's not viable for us to build. And now we have the state stepping and say, okay, we'll give you half a billion of everybody's money to incentivize you to build in a market like this. This is a very broken market. The big issue, by the way, here is that we have no transparency around how these decisions have been made. What's the evidence that supports that this policy approach is going to work? So, I mean, one of the things that we've been arguing for very many years now is for the right to housing to be enshrined in the Irish Constitution. That would not mean, and it staggers me that policymakers don't seem to understand what that would mean. It would not mean that I could head off down to the forecourts if I wasn't given a house tomorrow. It would mean, however, that if there was a suggestion that a policy decision like this was not evidence-based, if it wasn't transparently evidence-based, it could be challenged. So it could mean, for instance, that a group of people who could be impacted by this could seek from government clarification on the basis upon which they made this policy decision. Give us the evidence that shows this is going to work. If that evidence doesn't exist, it could be challenged before the courts, and government would be told, no, you simply can't hand over 500 million of public money to developers without being able to demonstrate there's a high likelihood, and it's supported by evidence, that this will deliver a good housing outcome. So if it can't do that, you have to go away and rethink the policy position. That's the kind of transparency that we need to ensure that we're getting evidence-based decision-making, because the decision-making that we've had over the last 20 years on how we respond to people's needs for housing has been deeply, deeply flawed. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah, look, we could talk about that all day. And the other story that I think really riled people up on the front page of the Business Post as well, houses being left empty rather than reduce the rents from institutional landlords. But unfortunately, we've run out of time. My thanks to my guest, Colm McGorman, Executive Director of Amnesty International, and Aoife Barry, Assistant News Editor at thejournal.ie.
On the record with Gavin Riley on News Talk